we were discussing the role of elders. And one of the things that we noticed about the eldership is that it is located within a local church. We didn't spend a lot of time talking about this. It's something that we've talked about on a number of different occasions. Acts, the 14th chapter, when Paul went about, he was actually appointing elders in the churches in the various cities that he had visited earlier. We talked a little bit about elder as a description of a work, not an office. So you really, I always think about this in terms of having a professor emeritus at a university. That's generally somebody who has been a professor, who has retired, no longer teaches classes, but gets to keep his office at the university. That way he has a place to go and work. And we don't have that with the eldership. Eldership is a description of the work that someone is doing. And when they don't do that work, then they just stop being an elder. That's not to say that they stop doing everything that they were doing, but that they stop functioning in that role. And in that sense, Ron, who is retiring as an elder, will continue to function in some roles within the church. And we are, of course, thankful that we have those folks. We also have Charlie, who was functioning as an elder and then had to step back from that role. And as his health has declined, Charlie has had to step back even a little further. But elder is a description of a work that needs to be done. We talk about that a little bit as we conclude our discussion tonight. And then the way that I kind of try to understand 1 Timothy and Titus is that the apostle talks about some roles that elders filled before they became elders. And it's based on our observance of those roles that they then work as elders. So these are the kinds of things that we talked about as roles that they could play and often did play before they became elders. They were leaders in practicing hospitality. We talked about that. They were leaders in domestic life. And this is where I had the wrong reference up there. The reference should be 1 Timothy 3 at verse 4. So I'll ask Jerry if he could to replace the bad PowerPoint that we had last week with this week's PowerPoint, and that'll correct that for me. They are leaders in fervently serving the Lord. And in Romans, the 12th chapter, the importance of that passage is to say that all of us can be leaders in fervently serving the Lord. And those are the kinds of people that we look for. I don't see that as described really in 1 Timothy and Titus, but I do see that. I conclude that that's a quality that we ought to observe in the elder or in the life of someone before they become an elder that forms the basis upon which we would ask them to serve as elders. They are leaders in the community where they are located. And that could be the broad community where they live. It could be the community that they work in. They have a good report of those that are without. They're leaders in disposition. They're temperate, they're self-controlled, they're gentle, and that's what causes us to consider them as elders. They're leaders in generosity, they're leaders in skillful teaching, and the passage that we looked at was Paul's instruction to Timothy about the things that Timothy had heard from Paul he was supposed to impart to faithful men who would be able to teach others also. And that just tells us that we ought to see leaders in teaching in skillful ways among those that are apt to teach or careful to teach. 1 Timothy 3 at verse 2, of course, he mentions that specifically with reference to the elders. And then I think there are some characteristics that must not be present when we consider someone to be an elder. And these characteristics mitigate against being an effective elder. And these tend to be the things that we focus on when we look at elders. And I don't think that this is I don't think that's the best way to approach this. I think the best way to approach it is we're looking for elders, and these are characteristics that mitigate against effectiveness. So let's think about them for just a little bit. They must not be a person who is rightly accused of reproach or someone who is not respectable. And, you know, not to make this a political speech, but there are a lot of people that are in some ways good leaders, but they're accused of reproach. And it's an appropriate accusation. Remember, an accusation could be made against anybody. Even an accusation was made against Jesus, that he was a glutton, that he was eating with sinners. And you know, that was true. He was eating with sinners, but it's not reproachable. So they should not be people who are accused of reproach. And can I get somebody to read 1 Timothy 3 at verse 2?
An overseer then must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach.
Right. So this is where I come to the conclusion that this person must be above reproach. Any other comments about that characteristic?
Dean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that the person who's making the act, the accuser is not an unnamed source. It has to be somebody who is seen or done, knows exactly what happened. It's not, well, I heard from so-and-so who said so-and-so who said so-and-so. It's, you have to have the person who's swearing be trustworthy.
Yeah, yeah. There are all kinds of tests that we would apply to testimony that someone would give, and that's one of the tests. We would want them to be a named source, if you know, to use your phraseology. Now, this might come from outside, and in that case, that would not be somebody that we would be familiar with, but it's still someone that we should vet. We should know whether or not this person is reliable making this accusation. That's a good point. Other comments? Okay. next characteristic that mitigates against being an effective elder would be overindulging in wine. Somebody want to read 1 Timothy 3 at verse 3? And tell us what translation you're reading it from.
From the New American Standard, not addicted to wine or pugnacious, but gentle, peaceable, free from the love of money.
Okay. That was the New American Standard?
Yes, it was.
Okay. The New American Standard, the 1995 translation? Everybody knows. Yeah. The old American, New American Standard says not overindulging in wine, or not given to wine, not given to drunkenness, if you're reading from the New International Translation. So comments.
I've often equated this to the idea of clear thought, because those that are given to drunkenness or given too much wine have a tendency to think in unclear ways and to reason without reason, where we're called upon as elders, our elders are called upon to give clear thought and to be ready to attend to at any moment.
Okay.
I think those that would be given to drunkenness or given too much wine are not in that position.
Okay.
Perhaps that's a more modern way of thinking of it.
Okay. And in this characteristic, I would include not just wine, but I would include anything that tends to unclear thought.
Mm-hmm.
The word there is specific to wine, but in many places it's the word that's related to pharmacy. So one who is not overcome with any substance that would make for unclear judgment.
Or impaired.
Yeah. Yeah.
The person who is given to too much excess like that, that's where you're more likely to get somebody from the community to say, I saw this person get into their car and drive when they had been, you know, too intoxicated, or they've been spouting off things that they shouldn't. I mean, this is where the community really can come forth and say something.
Yeah, that there's some validity to that. That's the kind of thing that's going to be noticed in the community more than it is by members of the church. Even people who do overindulge in wine don't typically do that in the company of other Christians. They just don't. I do a sermon on this kind of unclear thought, and I talk about, a lot of people, when they go to the White House for some kind of big major event, they're asked to come to the White House. They might be people who get drunk when they're at a frat party, but they would never get drunk when they went to the White House. They just don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something to be said for where this is going to be seen. So we have a person who is not a lover of money. And I think, and we've already read 1 Timothy 3 at verse 3, that concludes that passage by saying that they're not a lover of money. The King James translation says, not greedy, a filthy lucre. those are words that we just typically don't use. We use greedy, but we don't use filthy as applied to money. And we don't, I don't know anybody who refers to money as lucre. So just to say that this is not a lover of money. And it was true that in the first century and for centuries after that, elders were supported in some cases by churches. And just like a minister is not a person who is a teacher because of money, elders should not be elders because of money. They do have that right to be supported, but that's not the reason that they are the kind of people that they are. Other thoughts?
Dean, isn't this one of the major problems that the Pharisees and the Sadducees had, is that they were lovers of money instead of the law?
In some cases, yes. What I can read in Edersheim, The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, there were Pharisees, and not as much the Pharisees as it was the Sadducees, who did have a great deal of money because of their political connections. And the Pharisees, on the other hand, tended to be much less wealthy. But nevertheless, that was a problem. I think the way that I would describe the problem of the Pharisees is that they loved the praise of people. And the Sadducees loved their political connections and what that could do for them. The Sadducees were the group that bought, for the most part, that bought and sold the high priest's office. They bribed the Roman officials to make them the high priest. And that's how Caiaphas came to that position. So, yeah, they were... It was not uncommon for them to have seen people who were in a position of religious leadership, who were, in fact, doing it for the money.
Thank you.
Yeah, good point. Go ahead, Carol.
Just said thank you.
Okay.
I like your clarity.
Okay. Let's read 1 Timothy 3 at verse 6.
He must not be a recent convert, or he may become conceited and fall under the same judgment as the devil. That's NIV.
Okay. The King James uses the word novice, not a novice, lest he become conceited and fall into the reproach of the devil. So it would not be a person who was newly converted. I don't think that means that it's a person who's been a Christian, that we would say it's a person who's been a Christian for at least 30 years, because I know the Apostle Paul was going about appointing elders in within just 1 or 2 years of the time that he had established those churches. Now, there was a spiritual gift component to that, perhaps. There was a familiarity, because most of these people had come out of Judaism, and there was a great familiarity with Jewish law and with spiritual things. But not always. But these should not be people who are newly converted. Any thoughts?
I remember somebody saying that, because some people like to say, well, there's an age limit. They ought to be 50 or 55, you know, before they're qualified. And they were talking about the Philippines and said that, you know, many of the men don't live past the age of 45 or 50. So you're making it so that they, by putting an age limit on it, you're making it so their society doesn't get the benefit of their knowledge, where this does not have an age limit. It just has a knowledge limit on it.
Yeah. And a person who in our country today, a person who is 30 years old, has only probably recently married and has very young children. And so I don't see that his children could ever be accused of riot and unruly. They're just not of that age. So in our country to say, well, you're probably looking at people who are 50 years old, that makes some sense. But like you say, in the Philippines, where people marry at 16 and start having kids immediately, by the time you're 30 years old, you've got two kids who are probably having kids of their own. And so it is not an age restriction as much as it is an experience restriction.
Yeah, for me, it's somebody that's seasoned, experienced, has had some life experiences, understands the workings of the church, thorough knowledge of the Bible, and usually that comes with age. I don't think a specific number can be placed. I know elders that have been appointed probably in their early 40s, but they met all that criteria.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Kim is fond of saying that there are some people who have 30 years of experience in their job, and there are other people who have experienced their first year 30 times. So we want people who have acquired experience, and in business, just like in the church, they become very valuable people because they've been knocked around, they've made some mistakes, they know what it's like to be a Christian. But good point, David.
I think seasoned is a great way to put it, because there are certain trials, and we talk about the idea that we learn through the trials that we go through. And as a Christian who has, when you walk through those trials, you learn and become seasoned in how to handle them and how to handle them with grace and to see God's grace through those trials.
Yeah, right.
And to help to lead others through those trials.
Right. Right. I think you're right.
I love that term, seasoned. It's a good one.
Yep. I like seasoned citizen better than I do senior citizen.
You're just salt and pepper.
Okay. 1 Timothy 3 at verse 2. The King James says that this would be a person the New International Translation says faithful to his wife. Other translations say that he manages his own family well, and that the King James translation says that he must be the husband of one wife. And the technical translation of that phrase is that he must be a one-woman man. I think that's because an elder needs a wife in order to be able to do the job. There are some people who look at this and say the husband of one wife was intended to restrict the eldership so that a person who had two or more wives when they were converted, and then becomes a Christian, he doesn't have one wife. He has multiple wives. There are other people who say, well, if you're married and your wife dies and you have a second marriage, that you are no longer the husband of one wife. You're the husband of two wives. I don't see that in this characteristic, but I do see that doing the job of an elder requires you to have a wife. Other thoughts? And I know that in this congregation, when someone loses their wife, they have stepped down from being an elder because they did not have a wife.
Dean?
Yeah.
I think that's as much of a safeguard for the elder as it is who loses a spouse as it is for the congregation, because he can be put into a situation where somebody wants counseling or whatever, and put into a compromised situation, when he's grieving, he doesn't need to be put in that situation. And at first I thought, well, why? He's the same person. But I think it's sort of a protection that God gives them.
Could be, and a good thought. You know, even as a preacher, I don't meet with women in a private setting. That's just for my protection. But I don't think there's... I think that you make a good point that it could be for the protection of the individual who's serving as an elder.
Especially when he's grieving. If he's lost his wife, and he's really in a situation where he needs to be shepherded, not doing the shepherding.
Yeah. Yeah. Something to be said for that. A lot to be said for that. Okay. 1 Timothy 3 at verse 3 says that this must be a person who must... Let me get there again. I want to read that from the New International Translation. It says, not given to drunkenness, not violent, but gentle, not quarrelsome, and not a lover of money. This needs to be a person who is not what I call a bully, or a person who is contentious. Other thoughts, comments?
Well, it's easier. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Eileen.
I was just going to say it's easier to talk to somebody like that. And if you're going to talk to a person who's an elder, you want to feel comfortable with that person. And you want them to, when I say comfortable, in a perfectly pure situation, you want to be able to know that they're... compassionate, and that they will listen, and not just well, you just, if they're that way, you can go to them and talk to them. I wouldn't want to go to somebody and talk to them about a problem and have them just be the type of person that says, well, that's you know, you can tell people, you can tell by their mannerisms whether you can talk to them or not. I'm probably making a mess of this, but that's how I feel. You have to be able to know that they will listen and that they care.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you don't, when you're hurting, you don't necessarily need to be beaten about the head and shoulders with the breastplate of righteousness.
Right. Right. Well, I don't know. In my case, maybe I do. No. but I mean, you know what I mean. I think our elders, we can go to them and talk to them, and you too, and about stuff. And you're kind.
Yeah. I think this is really important, even to look at the functioning of the eldership by itself. You don't want somebody who is a bully as a part of the eldership, because what the eldership has to do is reach consensus about the activities that the church is going to be involved in. And you know, you don't want somebody who says, well, it's my way or the highway. You know, it's my ball. I'm going to take it and go home if you don't agree with me. That's the bully. That's the contentious person. And we've all been around people that are like that. So I think that's an important characteristic, because I think that destroys the effectiveness of an eldership. It destroys the effectiveness of a single elder, but I think it destroys the effectiveness of the eldership as well.
I think the other piece that comes out of this is the idea that a bully, their goal, or someone who is contentious or quarrelsome, their goal is to seek to harm or intimidate those whom they are conversing with. And I think the idea that we want our elders to not have that spirit of wanting to intimidate is critical.
Yeah. Good point. Good point. So do you, you know, I could have put this idea into a leadership quality when we say somebody is a leader in disposition. We talked about temperate, self-controlled, gentle. We could also put not a bully there. But I chose to put it here just because of the way that it's phrased. So that's why I put it here. Does anybody see other characteristics that you think I've not listed? I really didn't intend for this to be an exhaustive listing, but just a way of thinking about the characteristics of leadership.
Dean?
Yeah.
One of the things that I thought of, what was a characteristic of a good teacher, you know, you there, when you teach, you go, well, this person is or this person isn't, and you think about it. And I think that the best teacher, which is what an elder does, is teaches, is a problem solver. They are a good listener. And they hear what the problem is, and they go to God, and God gives them the answer, and they're able to counsel the person. And I think that's a big position of an elder.
That's an interesting take on being a good teacher, and has a lot of value. Other comments or thoughts?
Dean?
Yeah.
The idea of being peaceable, it would be difficult for a bully to encourage unity in the church.
Yeah, that's a very good point. You say it'd be very difficult. Why is it so difficult? What is it that makes it so difficult?
Well, they're wanting their way, and no, they have a closed mind. They don't listen to anybody else, only what is in their head.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it closes up anyone else. They don't want to be around that sort of person.
Yeah.
A bully is sort of the opposite of what we're supposed to do, which is to serve.
Okay, why do you say it's the opposite of that?
Well, because somebody who is serving is being humble. They're relinquishing power to serve and put another person above them. And when you're a bully, you want power over people.
Yeah. Yeah, and I, you know, in a negative sense, I think about a man like Diotrephes, who loved to have the preeminence among them. And so if you didn't agree with Diotrephes, he's put you out of the church. And so in a negative sense, I think he's an example of a person who is a bully.
I agree with the Faye's comment about unity. I think somebody that's not self-serving, you know, I witnessed a situation at another church where somebody kind of, they had an agenda, their own agenda. It wasn't a team agenda. And they made little cliques and tried to alienate people. And ultimately, their goal was to split the church. And they ended up losing their position. But it took a lot of strife, a lot of discontent. And I think it's more being elders, being on a team, you know, being having peace, your role model. Your wife is a role model for the younger women. So to me, an elder is kind of like a senior leader. Doesn't mean you have to be a senior in age, but just means that you're, back to my seasoned comment, you know, you're experienced.
Yeah, I think that's a point well taken. And, you know, I think about when I read this, a person who is a leader in this kind of disposition, I think about the Supreme Court of the United States. We have conservatives, we have liberals on the court. They're politically about as far apart as they could possibly be, but they come together and find they come together to attempt to find what the truth of a situation is, and I think they in many cases do it extremely well.
Dean?
Yeah.
I think it's connected a little bit, or there's a clue in verse 6 where he says that the new convert shouldn't be an elder, and the reason is he will become conceited.
That's an interesting point. Interesting point.
I think the idea of humility is something that is really hit on in Titus 1:7, where we look at the humble nature of the role of an elder. What I thought was really interesting is I've just been scrolling back and forth between different versions. New International leaves that off. New American Standard, King James, I've gone through four or five different ones. And initially, we have not self-willed, and New American Standard leaves that off, moves from blameless to not quick-tempered. But I think that's one of those that has to be there, is the idea that the not seeking yourself and having that humility to serve and seek others.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a point that's well taken. Other thoughts? And I would only conclude this section by looking at some instructions that the Apostle Paul gave Timothy in 1 Timothy 5. I think this is my impression that when the apostle writes this in 1 Timothy 5, he has reference to appointing elders. In verse 22, he says, "Do not be hasty in the laying on of hands. Do not share in the sins of others. Keep yourself pure." And if you drop down to then verse 24, he says, "The sins of some are obvious, reaching the place of judgment ahead of them. The sins of others often trail behind them. In the same way, the good deeds are obvious, and even those that are not obvious cannot remain hidden forever." I think there's wisdom in saying you need to get to know the characteristics, the leadership qualities of those men that you are considering. You know, most of us can be good for a little while. We can put on a fake persona. You know, I mean, I was pretty nice when I was dating Kim, and we can all of us guys can testify. Yeah, I can be a nice guy. So you want to examine someone over time, because their real character eventually comes out. It will not be hidden forever. So other thoughts, other than that. So let's kind of go back to the analysis that we started with. We considered the roles that people had filled, that we examined, and then I want to look at the roles that the elders fill after they are appointed. And these are roles that no one fills until they're appointed. You're going to have leaders who are good teachers who are not appointed to be elders, and that's not a contradiction there in any way. But there are, as I see it, two roles that an elder fills that nobody else fills. So the first of those is one that I have talked about, and you know, you've heard me talk about this on different occasions. It's in Hebrews, the 13th chapter, and at verse 17, this is what the writer says here: "Have confidence in your leaders and submit to their authority, because they keep watch over you as those who must give an account." The only people that I see in all of the New Testament who are called to give an account for someone else is the elders. We all have to give account for ourselves. That's undeniable. Teachers have to be careful about what they teach, because it affects other people. But teachers are not told that they give account for the people that they're teaching. The elders are told, you give an account for those that are entrusted to your care. And that means that means a lot. That makes being an elder a scary thing. Comments, questions? I've seen the way our elders function here. Yeah, you know, and I'm thinking of my experience. I've seen Ron and Charlie and Lenny and Ted and how they function. And I know that they are, in a sense, in awe, and not fearful, But just understanding the awful gravity of the position that they're in, they have to give an account for other people. So that means that they take a great deal of care. And then the other role that they're called upon to assume is that of the shepherd. And Jesus had a lot to say about shepherds and hirelings, and you know, the hireling flees. But to be a shepherd means that you're willing to stand in the gap and to protect the flock from those that would prey upon it. And that's a vital role. It's kind of like the sheepdog illustration that was in the bulletin several weeks ago. The sheepdog who is terribly injured, but eventually stood down the wolf that was attacking the flock. You being ready to give your life in that way, this in some ways is parallel to the role that the husband plays in the family. He is the protector of the family, not the only protector. Wives are just as much protectors as husbands are in some respects, but when it comes down to it, it's the husband, it's the elder who says, you go to a place of safety. I will hold off those that are coming against you until I can be sure that you're safe. I will sacrifice my own life. I'm not going to cut and run. And being a shepherd is it's almost like giving an account for someone else. It's a scary responsibility to take on, the responsibility of being a shepherd, and say, I will defend you. Acts, the 20th chapter, the Apostle Paul met with the Ephesian elders when he was traveling on his way to Rome. And he knew that it was probably the last time that he was going to meet with them. And he told those elders to shepherd the flock. And I think of, you know, men like Paul. I think of men like Peter, who were willing to stand in the gap. Not that Paul was an elder. Peter was, but as an apostle, he perhaps had the same responsibility that the elders do in this regard. Let's look at these two passages and read them very quickly. Can somebody read Acts 20, verses 28 through 31?
Be on guard for yourselves and for all the flock among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers, to shepherd the church of God, which he purchased with his own blood. I know that after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock. And from among your own selves, men will arise, speaking perverse things, to draw away the disciples after them. Therefore, be on the alert, remembering that night and day for a period of 3 years, I did not cease to admonish each one with tears.
Okay. Can somebody read 1 Peter 5, verses 2 and 3? And this is written, 1 Peter 5 is written from the perspective of an elder.
Tend the flock of God, which is among you, exercising the oversight, not of constraint, but willingly, according to the will of God, nor yet for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind, neither as lording it over the charge allotted to you, but making yourselves ensembles to the flock.
Yeah. Comments about these roles. Okay, well, thank you for considering these, and I realize that that's a bit of a different kind of approach to consider the characteristics of leadership first, and not to focus on those things that mitigate against being an effective leader. So I thank you for giving me your attention and letting me share that with you.